for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, along with Scott Forrester, answering our phones this morning, engineering the program. Morning, Scott.
Good morning, Tom. Thank you for letting me be on here for a second.
Oh, great fun. Yeah. Glad to have you here. And Heidi Tauber is still... Hey, Heidi. What a morning.
Hello.
Hey.
You got me off guard.
I just wanted to say hi. That's all. Heidi does our morning show on KPOJ, AM 620 KPOJ. William F. Schultz. This has to be the biggest story of the month of May. And yet, did you see this anywhere? I don't think anybody saw this anywhere. This is absolutely incredible. William F. Schultz, the executive director of Amnesty International USA, Amnesty International, the group, you know, everybody's talking about, well, Amnesty International came out and they said, America has gulags. Yeah, they said that. But what hasn't been reported in the American press, at least to the best of my knowledge, and maybe I've missed something, and if I have, please let me know. I thought I'd been looking for this kind of stuff, but, you know, maybe that just slipped under my radar. If I'm wrong on this, our telephone number, toll free all across the United States, 1-866-889-8894. And, of course, you can drop into our live chat room by going to TomHartman.com and clicking live chat. That'll get you there. Anyhow, if this just seems to me like just such a huge story. William F. Schultz, the executive director of Amnesty International USA, called for nations around the world to investigate George W. Bush Jr. and determine if he had committed crimes, and if so, to arrest him when he shows up in their country. Oh, you hadn't heard about that? You missed the New York Times discuss it? Me too. I found this on the website of Amnesty International. AmnestyUSA.org/annualreport/statement.html. It's right there. AmnestyUSA.org/annualreport/statement.html. And if you can't remember that, go to TomHartman.com, click live chat, drop into the chat room, and somebody there will repost it for you, because we've got some real internet whizzes, some really smart folks who really know the web there. Anyhow, here, I'll just share with you the language of this. I mean, this is just so straightforward. He says, good morning. I'm William F. Schultz, executive director at Amnesty International USA. Today, Amnesty International releases its annual report on the state of human rights around the world. What we have found brings shame to governments from Afghanistan to the United States. We have documented that the use of torture and ill treatment is widespread, and that the U.S. government is a leading purveyor and practitioner of this odious human rights violation. And then it gets worse. I just threw that in. And then it gets worse. Back to quoting Mr. Schultz. The refusal of the U.S. government to conduct a truly independent investigation into the abuses of Abu Ghraib prison and other detention centers is tantamount to a whitewash, if not a cover-up, of these disgraceful crimes. It is a failure of leadership. Gee, where have I heard that before? It is a failure of leadership to prosecute only enlisted soldiers and a few officers while protecting those who designed a deliberate government policy of torture and authorized interrogation techniques that constitute torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. The government's investigation must climb all the way to the top of the military and civilian chain of command. All the way to the top. If the U.S. government continues to shirk its responsibility, still quoting William Schultz, the executive director of Amnesty International USA, if the U.S. government continues to shirk its responsibility, Amnesty International calls on foreign governments. Now, listen carefully. Remember General Pinochet? He showed up in England and they arrested him for the crimes when he was the president of Chile? If the U.S. government continues to shirk its responsibility, Amnesty International calls on foreign governments to uphold their obligations under international law by investigating all senior U.S. officials involved in the torture scandal. And if those investigations support prosecutions, the governments should arrest any official who enters their territory and should begin legal proceedings against them. The apparent high-level architects of torture should think twice before planning their next vacation to places like Acapulco or the French Riviera, because they may find themselves under arrest, as Augusto Pinochet famously did in London in 1998. Now, we pulled out of the International Criminal Court in large part to protect Henry Kissinger, or at least it was perceived as that in the beginning. I would suggest it goes beyond that. I would say that we pulled out of the International Criminal Court because Junior, Bush Jr. and his buddies believed themselves to be above the law, and they didn't want to be bothered by things like the International Criminal Court. They didn't want to be bothered by things like having to comply with international law. They didn't want to have to bother with things like treaties. Remember Alberto Gonzalez? Yes, the Geneva Convention is quaint, outdated. The Geneva Convention, which was put into place not to protect prisoners of war from other countries, not to protect the bad guys. It was put into place to protect our soldiers. I mean, or at least that's why we signed it. I mean, for every country in the world that signed the thing, it came out of, you know, activity in Switzerland originally, but for every country in the world that signed the Geneva Conventions, their sole motivation, it was not altruistic, their sole motivation was to protect their own soldiers. Because one of the lessons of war has been that the way that you treat the other side's captives, more often than not, is how the other side will treat your captives. And so, you know, we signed the first through fourth protocols of the Geneva Convention, and so on. But Bush Jr., George Jr., not so excited about that, not so interested in that. Amnesty International goes on to just lay out to the nations of the world, which, of course, in my mind raises the question, which of the nations in the world will have the intestinal fortitude to actually say, okay, we are going to participate in the prosecution, or at least the investigation, of high crimes and misdemeanors. U.S. Congress obviously isn't going to look into it, by the Bush administration. International crimes. Anyhow, Amnesty International lays out a list. Here it is again in the AmnestyUSA.org annual/annualreport/statement.html. Amnesty International's list of those who may be considered high-level torture architects includes Donald Rumsfeld, who approved a December 2002 memorandum that permitted such unlawful interrogation techniques as stress positions, prolonged isolation, stripping, and the use of dogs at Guantanamo Bay. William Haynes, the Defense Department General Counsel who wrote that memo. And Douglas Feith, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, who is cited in the memo as concurring with its recommendations. Our list, says Amnesty International, or says Mr. Schultz, the senior executive, the executive director of Amnesty International USA, William F. Schultz. He says, our list includes Major General Jeffrey Miller, commander of the Joint Task Force Guantanamo. Now, this is the guy at Guantanamo who was torturing people there, and they sent him to Iraq, and all of a sudden they start torturing people in Abu Ghraib. And we've got all these folks in Abu Ghraib who are saying, we're just doing this because, you know, Jeffrey Miller told us to. Or the people working under him. Soften up the prisoners. But the Bushies would like us to think that little Lindy England, in all her infinite wisdom, when she got called up to go to Iraq, even though the job that she was told she was going to be assigned to was as a file clerk, that she just happened to bring with her some dog collars and leashes some electrical wires and clips. Because she was thinking ahead. So anyhow, their list includes Major General Jeffrey Miller, the commander of the Joint Task Force Guantanamo, whose subordinates used some of the approved torture techniques, and who was sent to Iraq, where he recommended the prison guards soften up detainees for interrogations. Former CIA Director George Tenet, whose agency kept so-called ghost detainees off registration logs and hidden during visits by the Red Cross, and whose operatives reportedly used such techniques as waterboarding, feigning suffocation, stress positions, and incommunicado detention. And it includes Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, who called the Geneva Conventions quaint and obsolete in a January 2002 memo, and who requested the memos that fueled the atrocities at Abu Ghraib. Amnesty International USA continues to with their list of people that they suggest foreign countries should investigate because the United States Congress, under Republican control, will not. I mean, they don't say it quite in those terms, but they explicitly say foreign governments should investigate and should arrest these people if they show up on their property, if they have been found to have committed these crimes. Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, the former commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, Sanchez's deputy, Major General Walter Wojcicki, and Captain Carolyn Wood, who oversaw interrogations at Bagram Air Base. And then the kicker. While this, they say, again, quoting from William Schultz, the executive director of Amnesty USA, Amnesty International USA, while this is by no means an exhaustive list of those who deserve investigation, we would be remiss if we ignored President George W. Bush's role in the scandal. President Bush signed a February 2002 memo stating that the Geneva Conventions did not apply to Taliban or Al-Qaeda detainees and that their humane treatment should be congruent or contingent on military necessity. This set the stage for tragic abuses of detainees. Without full and impartial investigations of all players, the torture scandal will come to be as indelibly associated with the Bush presidency as Teapot Dome is with Warren Harding's or Watergate with Richard Nixon's. Amnesty International calling on the nations of the world to investigate and, if appropriate, arrest George W. Bush Jr. Pretty amazing. And what kind of publicity is this getting in the United States? Let me know. 1-866-889-8894. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Let's get it started. Ha! Let's
get it started in here. Let's get it started. Ha! Let's get and it started. And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. William F. Schultz, the executive director of Amnesty International USA, suggesting that other countries around the world should do what London, what England did, what the United Kingdom did in 1998, when they arrested Augusto Pinochet and charged him with war crimes because citizens of Great Britain had been disappeared in Chile during his reign. Interesting. And where is the coverage of this? Tomas in Michigan on the line. Hey, Tomas.
Well, again, thank you for the opportunity, my left-wing brother. I would like to say that taking a bone from a little kitty cat that's just been born like Chile is going to be a lot more different than taking a bone from the United States. They did not try to arrest, you know, a senator or a general from the United States. It's going to be a totally different situation there.
Yeah.
And
you're absolutely right. Taking Pinochet was a big deal, and Pinochet had no power and no power base basically in Chile any longer. And even at that, it became an international incident. Do you recall that just a few months ago there was a big debate in Holland about whether George Bush should be arrested when he came to Holland, and it went all the way to the Dutch Supreme Court. Do you remember that?
Well, a lot of things can go to the Supreme Court, all right? I mean, it doesn't mean that they
have... But the Dutch Supreme Court ruled that he may well be a war criminal, and they may well have all the correct and legal reasons to arrest him, but that that they were not going to proffer the indictment against him because they didn't want to see Holland involved in a potential conflict with the United States. They went.
Well, I'm not going to criticize the Dutch because I love the way they stood up to the Euro Constitution the other day.
Yeah, I agree.
But I want to go for a solution here instead of being confrontational with you. And many times the United States will be in a conflict, and we respect the Geneva Convention, and the other side does not. Now, what do you do in that case? Because, for example, North Korea or Vietnam or Japan in World War II, and in many instances in the ongoing difficulties, shall we say. What do we do in that situation?
What you do is you hold those countries accountable. That's why we had the Nuremberg trials after World War II. And, I heard John McCain on TV about a month or so ago, who was a prisoner of war in North Vietnam for, 4 years, almost 5 years, say that had it not been for the Geneva Conventions, there was no doubt in his mind that he would have been tortured much worse than he was, that his treatment would have been horrific, and he might not have survived. So even though the North Vietnamese didn't comply with the letter of the law of the Geneva Conventions, it was a restraining force. I mean, the Geneva Conventions go back to 1864 when the thing first started. They were revised again after World War II. They were revised again in 1977, and they're pretty explicit.
But I'm sure you've read them as I have, and I can't quote them from memory. I'm not in front of my computer right now, but the Geneva Convention does state that for a military force to be covered by the Geneva Convention, it must meet certain requirements. So for example, they have to have some sort of uniform, they have to have some sort of organization. It seems to not cover, let's say, a popular uprising of the sort that we have in Iraq. But there are many of those uprisings that are going on all the time. What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, I have the Geneva Conventions printed out right here in front of me, and I'm looking through them, and I'm not seeing anything about uniforms. What I do see is capture combatants and civilians, which I guess would mean regardless of what kind of uniform you're wearing, right? Captured combatants, I'm quoting from the Geneva Conventions, and civilians who find themselves under the authority of an adverse party, in other words, you've been nailed, are entitled to respect for their life, their dignity, their personal rights, and their political, religious, and other convictions. They must be protected against all acts of violence or reprisal. They are entitled to exchange views with their families and news with their families and receive aid. Must enjoy basic judicial guarantees, and no one may be held responsible for an act he has not been committed. No one may be subject to physical or mental torture or to cruel or degrading corporal punishment or other treatment. It sounds to me like we're blowing it, Tomas.
All right. Well, listen. Thanks for the opportunity, and I'll try to email you with the part that I remember. Okay.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, tomhartman.com. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room and participate in the discussion, a rather lively one going on right now, as a matter of fact. And I'll tell you, this is the issue that I just tossed out at the opening of the program. We've got a lot of other things to talk about today as well. But this issue that the executive director of Amnesty International USA has come out and called on other nations around the world to investigate the actions of senior officials in the Bush administration, up to and including George W. Bush Jr., and prosecute them and imprison them if they visit those foreign countries for torture, for violations of international law. And you know, I just have to say, this seems to me like a really big deal. I mean, this is not some little, oh, gee, wouldn't that, isn't that interesting? No, I think this is a big deal. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Mark in Myrtle Beach on the line. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind?
Well, it just irritates me the way the government has played this urinating on a Koran as an accidental.
It's the
ventilation system moving the urine.
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, back in 1964, there was a young guy who was an assistant helper of, I forget his exact title. He was on the staff of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, which was a committee that the House of Representatives put together to look into the Kennedy killing. And this young kid, who had just, you know, a staff member, came up with this theory that this bullet had paused in midair for 1.2 seconds, you know, turned left 40 degrees, you know, went, you know, zoom, 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 right? The magic bullet theory. His name was Arlen Specter, and he was rewarded for his role in that by becoming United States Senator. I suspect that there's, you know, if Arlen Specter didn't come up with this, and I don't think he did, I think he's kind of moved on to other things, there's a new Arlen Specter around, because we now have the magic urine theory. And,
yeah, it's like these guys are being housed. That the government wants us to believe they're being housed in nice homes with air conditioning systems, and the guy happened to be by the heat pump, where actually these guys are housed in outdoor kennels with fans at the end of them, blowing straight onto the prisoners.
That's right. Yeah, and you can see it in the footage of the concentration camps that were operating there. And now Amnesty International has also come out and said that the concentration camps we're operating in Guantanamo Bay are not the only ones we're operating around the world, that there are others that we're holding, that we're keeping secret, that are under our control. And then on top of that, you get, you know, the BBC reporting about 3 weeks ago that we are now building a death chamber in one of the six concentration camps, or one of the five. There's five existing. We're building a sixth in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. So, you know, we're going to have a death camp. We have concentration camps. We're building them around the world. What has our nation come to? And I'll tell you, Mark, the con take on this is going to be, well, those guys are terrible. They hijacked an airplane and flew it into buildings, blah, blah, blah. Of course, most of the cons don't realize Iraq had nothing to do with that. But it was Saudis who are good friends of the Bush family. But nonetheless, they say those people are terrible. They don't follow the rules of war. They don't subscribe to the Geneva Convention. Therefore, we shouldn't. And if you follow that logic, that insane logic, what that says is, no matter, is however bad your opponent is, that's how bad you should become. And that is a death spiral. I am sorry. That is the most immoral, the most amoral, the most destructive to the interests of our nation position that any person, that's the most anti-American, that is spitting in the on the graves of our founders, the most
that's
un-American
right.
position that can be taken, and it is routinely taken by the likes of Bimbaugh and Hannity and O'Reilly, whose cruise, I understand, was just canceled for lack of interest.
Instead of raising up standards, we're
that's right.
going
we off. We have been, for the history, for the last 200 years, the last 230 years, until Junior came into office, we have been the beacon of liberty in the world. We have been the, you know, in Tiananmen Square, those 15,000 people marched, many of them to their death, many of them to lifelong imprisonment, and there's some of them are still in prison in communist China, the good friends of the Bush family. They marched to their death carrying a 36-foot-tall papier-mâché statue, a replica of the Statue of Liberty that they had called, they renamed it the Goddess of Democracy, quoting from Thomas Paine and Thomas Jefferson, the founders of the modern Democratic Party and modern liberalism. And these guys who say, oh, well, you know, we don't need to be the beacon of liberty anymore. We don't need to stand tall. We don't need to be the country that everyone wants to be like. We don't need to set the standards for decency and morality in the world. We can just get down there in the gutter and just be as bad as the rest of they are spitting on George Washington's grave, and it disgusts me.
Well, Mark, it infuriates me too.
Yeah, Mark, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894. Jim in Grand Rapids on the line. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Tom. Wow, I don't know where to start after that one.
So how at the beginning?
The Geneva Convention, Tomas made some great points. You look at the Geneva Convention, interestingly, you don't have the part that describes what enemies are in those situations. You have to be an army that represents a country with a flag, a uniform, clearly displayed. There's some other things I don't have in front of me. These guys clearly do not do that. Saudi Arabia didn't attack us. It was Al-Qaeda. These guys are from all kinds of countries. No, we definitely don't stoop to their level. As you say, I agree with that. A lot of these things they call torture, they're not torture in my mind. Matter of fact, they do those things because of the...
Jim, let's just stop and go back because you're just throwing things out here one after another.
I know, because you went through so much.
I understand. Okay, I'll go along with you on this. I'll agree with you that Al-Qaeda is not a government and that it is not a country.
Right.
And so if it's not a government and it's not a country, then what is it?
It is a force of a bunch of thugs that want to turn the world into the way they want it to be.
Exactly.
It is also known as a criminal enterprise,
right?
Right. So we're dealing with
something that's like the mafia. We're dealing with a criminal
enterprise. In a way, yeah.
Right. So now, do criminals have rights under the Geneva Convention?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And now, these guys have rights. Don't get me wrong. I don't say torture them, but I don't think sleep deprivation, having these guys stand. We do those things as opposed to physical, you know what I mean, like... sleep deprivation, having these guys stand. We do those things as opposed to physical, you know what I mean, like bamboos under fingernails, all that.
Over 50 people have died as a consequence of being in our custody.
These guys cut people's heads off while they're alive. They film it and put it on the Internet.
We're
not dealing with an army. We're dealing
with Jim, you're back to the they're bad, so we should be bad,
no,
right?
No, that's not what I said.
Okay, then let's talk about the taxi driver, the guy who just happened to be a taxi driver in Afghanistan, who's now down in Guantanamo Bay.
Sure.
And who we are saying, we don't think he has anything to do with it, but we're not sure what to do about him.
Right.
What about the guys who were waterboarded and who drowned?
I think
what
those
about the
people,
you know the,
I think
you don't know
people,
that any of the people whose heads got cut off are in Guantanamo who are cutting off heads.
No,
are in Guantanamo.
I didn't say
Bay.
I think the guys that are down there, most of them are from the original Afghanistan.
Most of
Look,
them were
the United States.
We were paying a bounty for people.
We liberated over 50 million people the last few years. That sounds like the beacon of liberty to me. Now, you want to turn some of this and twist it that we're the bad guys. I don't believe we...
Oh, this is great rhetoric, Jim, but is it really worth the lives of 1,600 Americans and $300 billion for us to have, quote, by your definition, to have liberated Afghanistan so that now the Taliban is back?
Yes, because, like we said, Al-Qaeda is not a country. They are from all over. And going into the hornet's nest area is what it takes.
No, you're nonsense. What we have done is we have immeasurably strengthened them, Jim. We have immeasurably strengthened them.
They hated us before we went there. What are you talking about?
There was Al-Qaeda was like 20,000 guys. Osama bin Laden was a little guy who kept jumping up and down saying, pay attention to me, pay attention to me, pay attention to me. And so
we paid attention when he killed 3,000 of my brothers and sisters.
We have not paid attention to him. Where is he?
George
W. Bush himself said, I don't think much about him anymore.
And if I wanted to hide, you couldn't find me either. Come on, he's one guy. He's inoperative.
Oh, I thought he was the bad guy.
Hey, is El Zarqawi on Amnesty's list?
Yeah. Jim, this is...
He's not on their list. How come they're after us and not him? Oh, my gosh.
No, these guys are criminals. You and I are agreeing that they are criminals and they should be treated as criminals. They should be arrested.
And
they should be prosecuted.
You're afraid to go get them.
No, I am absolutely in favor of arrest. No, I'm sorry, Jim.
We're going to strengthen them if we go after them.
Jim, I'm sorry. You are absolutely wrong. I am totally in favor of bringing to the dock people who engage in criminal behavior. If they're going to engage in criminal behavior, then we need to bring them down. But the difference between the way that Bill Clinton dealt with a criminal terrorist, Tim McVeigh, and the way George Bush dealt with a criminal terrorist, Osama bin Laden, is that Bill Clinton got us national closure. He prosecuted this guy. He put him in jail. He even put him to death because he was a criminal. He got together the Interpol. He got the police agencies of this country and all around the world together and said, okay, we're going to find this guy. He's a criminal. We're going to find out who's behind this, and we're going to bring them down. Whereas George Bush said, oh, no, I want to be Super George. I'm going to be the war president. It'll get the Republicans elected in 2002. It'll get me reelected in 2004. And he didn't even bother. Osama bin Laden is still gone, and we're running around declaring war on an abstraction instead of taking out the terrorists. Now, Jim, you may speak again. Jim, I had potted you down there because Jim is gone. Okay. Well, anyhow. Vicky in Grand Rapids. Hey, Vicky, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you? I just wanted to let you know that on Daily Kos today, Ted Kennedy posted the diary. It's now in the recommended diaries. It's on the Downing Street Minutes.
Uh-huh.
I think that's fabulous that we have a senator now posting there, as well as, you know, Conyers posts on a regular basis. And I'm really glad that the politicians are starting to pay attention to the blogs, because I think that they have a lot of power.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't know. I was excited to read that and wanted to share it with you. And also want to let you know that we're really glad you're here in Grand Rapids. And
well, thank you. I'll be there in I think 2 or 3 weeks on the 20th,
yeah.
24th. I'll be broadcasting live on that Friday, whatever the date is, toward the end of June there from the Celebration Cinema. Is it? The WTKG has a studio. So, well, we will see you then, Vicki. Thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you, Tom. Bye-bye.
I appreciate it. Good to hear from you, David in Missouri on the line. Hey, David.
How are you doing today, Tom?
I'm great. What's up?
Well, I wanted to comment on the gentleman that was just giving all the bullet points and not listening. I'm a veteran. I'm a son of a veteran. I'm the father of an active duty military personnel. And true patriotism is what Natalie of the Dixie Chicks did, stand up and say, I'm not happy with this man, to question the authority. It's not to blindly follow. Even when I was in the military, if the order was illegal, you had the right and the duty to step up against
it. Yeah. Yeah, well said. What troubles me about Jim's call is that he kept talking, he kept tossing out these very well-rehearsed talking points that had been focus group tested by Frank Luntz, and, you know, and we know this. I mean, Frank issues these 20, 30, 40-page memos to the Republicans, you know, with the talking points, and they've gone through serious, careful, focus group testing to make sure that the words resonate with people, and it was like they had been memorized. This is what happens to folks who watch too much Fox News, I think. It's just, you know, it's like a disease almost. It's a tragedy, really. Ultimately. Anyhow, it's strange times. William F. Schultz, the executive director of Amnesty International USA. And, you know, I can't click there on Spike as long as you're on the phone. Hey, Spike, what's up?
Hey, I have to call and laugh about that caller trying to discredit on behalf of his party, Amnesty International, considering how Donald Rumsfeld and the neocons are so quick to credit Amnesty International for rationale to invade a country.
Yeah.
But, you know, once it's suddenly against...
Yeah, they were quoting Amnesty International about the Taliban when we went into Afghanistan. In fact, they regularly and frequently quoted Amnesty International.
Which, you know, if these guys are such humanitarians, why doesn't neocons like that caller, why doesn't he push for the case to take a parasite like Henry Kissinger and imprison him for all the millions of people Kissinger killed and exterminated? I mean, you know, if they're such humanitarians, they want to bring freedom to the world, maybe they ought to look in their own backyard sometimes.
You know, the way to bring freedom to the world, and it's the way that we have brought freedom to the world, is by example. In 1776, we became the first representative democracy, for all practical purposes, in the history of the world. There, you know, in Greece, they had experimented with pure democracy, but we became the first representative democracy. By the time the Civil War happened, there was a handful. There were six or seven, arguably eight or nine. It depends on how you define it. A lot of folks think that, you know, Britain really didn't become a democracy until the British Revolution of 1836 or 1838. But anyhow, by the 1840s, 1850s, there was a handful. The whole world held their breath when we went through our Civil War. When we came out the other side of that Civil War, it began a process. The rest of the world started saying, hey, you know, this can work. We can do this. And now there's over 100 countries that are democratic in the world out of the 198, I mean, fully democratic, and arguably as many as 150 that are more or less democratic. And largely democratic. And you'll find the whole scoop and the list and everything in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? And we did it not by going in and saying, you are going to become a democracy at the barrel of a gun. We did it by saying, this is how it works. Don't you want to be like us? I remember Dick Gregory and I went over to Africa one time, and we were on the plane, and we were just talking, and he made this comment to me. It stuck with me so many years. He said, I don't know why we're running around the world trying to shove our way of life down people's throats with the barrel of a gun. He said, when you've got something good, you don't have to force it on people. They will steal it. And that's the thing, you know, that's what the folks in Tiananmen Square were trying to do. And why are we not supporting the independence movement in China? Well, because the you know, Chinese slave labor is making billions of dollars for the Walton heirs, who are major Republican donors. So we're sucking up to communist China. I mean, you want to talk about a regime that has killed millions of people, killed more people than in his wildest dreams Saddam Hussein ever wanted to kill, or the Taliban combined. Look at communist China. The best buds of the Bush administration. It's just irrationality reigns. I got to say, Spike. Sometimes it just gets so weird out there. Thanks a lot for the call from Easton, Pennsylvania. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. It's 10 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Day after day, I'm more confused.
Ah, you must be listening to Limbaugh.
But I look for the light through the pouring rain.
Oh, there you go. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. You must be living in Portland if it's pouring rain. Welcome back. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Rusty in Jacksonville, North Carolina on the line. Hey, Rusty, what's on your mind today?
My first time caller, long time listener.
Well, great, thank you.
Yeah, I want to talk about what that guy was saying earlier about what's going on in Afghanistan and everything.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about Jim, who said we've liberated Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah. I believe we should have stayed in Afghanistan. That's what my problem was. We should have stayed there. We shouldn't have gone into Iraq.
Yeah. I agree with you. I have some concerns about our having gone into Afghanistan in the first place. I thought we should have gone in and taken out Al-Qaeda and then left, frankly. And in fact, I thought that we should have cut the deal with the leaders of the Taliban, who were saying that they were willing to give us Osama bin Laden, and they were willing to shut down his operation. And then we could have prosecuted him, and it would have been over.
Exactly.
And it could have, and Al-Qaeda would have been revealed to the world as a criminal organization, and all over the world people would be saying, you know, that guy, he's a bum. He killed 3,000 people. He's a bum. He's a criminal. And instead, George said, no, we're not gonna do this through the courts like, you know, Clinton did with Tim McVeigh. We got to have a war here, because I want to be a war president, because no war president has ever not been reelected, you know. And so it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy.
Yeah, awesome. See, I also listen to you guys. I also listen to what's on Air America on Sirius.
Yeah.
And I listen to majority for one of the co-hosts, Janine Garofalo, believes Kerry won the election. I think she's right, because I think something must have happened in Ohio.
Yeah, I agree. She is right. And if you pick up the book, What Went Wrong in Ohio, it's the Conyers Commission report.
Yeah, the Conyers report and
everything. Just lays it all out there. Rusty, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Matt in Wichita, Kansas on the line. Hey, Matt, we got about a minute left. What's up?
Tom, I'm kind of going off subject here, but I don't know if you have read a piece that James Dobson put out in April. I'm trying to get through the whole thing, but I get so livid. He talks about supposedly Thomas Jefferson warning that the judiciary was the greatest threat that faced America. Now, I've read your book, What Would Jefferson Do? I don't know if you're familiar with what he wrote or not.
I'm not familiar with what Dobson said, but I'll tell you what. There was, in 1803, when the Marbury versus Madison case happened, and the head of the Supreme Court decided that the Supreme Court could overthrow legislation that had been passed by the legislature, Jefferson was flipped out about that. He was very worried that the Supreme Court was going to overreach. History has demonstrated Jefferson was wrong in that particular case. And you'll find a half a chapter on that in my book, Unequal Protection. So
okay,
apparently Dobson took that out of context and blew it all out of proportion.
That's the way I felt about it, Tom.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Matt. Good to hear from you. I appreciate
Thank you much.
Yep. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. He's the man who uncovered uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you on radio stations, live on radio stations from California to North Carolina, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, Live365's American FM, WhiteRoseSociety.org, podcasting from WhiteRoseSociety.org as well, and also on in cable systems in 29 states on CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. Very, 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 very pleased to have you with us. Bioneers. Bioneers are scientists and artists, gardeners and economists, activists and public servants, architects and ecologists, farmers and journalists, priests and shamans, policymakers and citizens. Bioneers are everyday people committed to preserving and restoring and supporting the future of life on Earth. They herald a dawning age of restoration founded in natural principles of kinship, interdependence, cooperation, reciprocity, and community. You can find out more about Bioneers at Bioneers.org, and one of the world's premier Bioneers, in my opinion, is Carolyn Raffensperger. She's an environmental lawyer and former archaeologist, the executive director of the Science and Environmental Health Network, a national consortium of environmental groups dedicated to the use of science to protect the environment and public health. Carolyn, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's good to be here.
It's great to have you here. You have been talking about and writing about the precautionary principle. And I lived in Germany for a year. I guess just from my writing and whatnot, I'm familiar with this. I don't think most Americans are, however, and I don't think most Americans understand that here in the United States we have a very different approach to science from the countries of Europe who operate, you know, on the foundation of the precautionary principle. So let's start out by talking about what is the precautionary principle.
Well, the precautionary principle is a really lovely idea, and you just mentioned that it comes from Germany, and it really is embedded in this idea that we don't even have an English word for, caring for the future, for caring for, you know, the difficult things that, and caring for it in a way that we need to be prepared for what's going to come down the path. The precautionary principle is an approach to scientific uncertainty that says rather than measuring and managing risk, we should actually try to prevent harm that's foreseeable and that where we've got good alternatives.
So, for example, in Germany, and this came, as I recall, this came out of the whole, in fact, when I was living there was this, which was in the mid-80s, there was this huge controversy and concern about the forest dying off. But this actually was quite a while before that, but it had to do with acid rain in the forests, and what do we do about this? And this idea came about, as I recall, instead of doing what we historically have done, which is you allow the damage of, for example, the Industrial Revolution, you allow the damage to happen, and then you say, okay, what lessons can we learn about how to prevent future damage? Let's say before a new product comes into the marketplace, before a new invention is used, before a new technology is used, that we have to prove that that technology is safe rather than trying to repair the damage of it after we discover that it's not safe.
That's a close idea. It's almost impossible to prove safety of anything, but we can compare options for meeting our goals and choose the safest alternative. So, you know, what we really do now is say, whoops, we put some new technology into the environment or even old ones that haven't been tested, and then we measure the dead bodies that are piled up in the streets. And
so
say,
in America we have the whoops principle.
Yeah, we have the whoops principle rather than the precautionary principle, exactly. So, the basic idea is when you can see something, when you can foresee some kind of harm, even though we haven't proven beyond a shadow of a doubt, you know, the cause and effect mechanism, we should try and prevent the harm. It's sort of like seeing a kid in the highway and running out and grabbing that child before the cars come and hit her. We don't have to say, oh, no, it's the car's 3 blocks away or 10 miles away. We take the kid out of the road.
Yeah, or a better metaphor might be we don't have to say, you know, it's going to cost a certain amount of energy to go out and collect that kid, and that energy has a certain value, and when you aggregate the value of that energy against the value of the life of the kid, if we're determining that the value of the life of the kid is, let's say, $250,000, which is the number I think that Ford was using when they were doing their calculations on the gas tanks back many years ago, it's really not worth it. It's not, you know, that's what we're doing is cost benefit equations, and what the Europeans are doing is human life. Well, how would you characterize it?
I don't know. I think it's a different set of values. You know, right now you can put money into your college kids, your kid's college fund, or you can start planning for her mastectomy. You know, that's the basic approach in the United States. And the precautionary principle is one of the very first decision rules that say we really need to put on the table what we love. And there are a lot of things that we love more than money. Our children's health, the white pelicans in North Dakota, worker health and safety. Those are the kinds of things that the precautionary principle says we need to use science in service of those values rather than only in service to money.
So for the average person in the United States, for the average person listening, how would life be different? What would America look like differently? How would it feel, sound, appear differently if we were using the precautionary principle in this country rather than the whoops principle?
Well, for one thing, we could actually trust government regulation of things like cosmetics. Right now, we know that there are things in cosmetics that can cause damage to little baby boys. And we know that women of reproductive age have more of these chemicals in their body right now. And we don't have any real idea of how much causes damage. We wouldn't put those things into cosmetics. We would try to find ways of making ourselves beautiful and healthy at the same time.
So you're suggesting in Germany the cosmetics are less toxic than the cosmetics here?
They're on the way to being that way. They're starting to find safer substitutes for the things in cosmetics that do harm to our health.
Yeah. And there are some really strong forces arrayed in opposition to the precautionary principle. You just talk about the precautionary principle at some science conferences, and it's enough to make certain groups go crazy. Who are they?
Well, you know, it's mostly trade associations that don't like this. So, you know, the American Chemistry Council and organizations of their ilk don't like it. And they're going to yell and scream and say that we're going to stop all progress and innovation as we know it. And in fact, the precautionary principle drives innovation because it helps us look for those safer alternatives. It helps us meet our goals in ways that don't poison the planet or our bodies.
Yeah, it seems like they're always offering a zero-sum game equation that if we don't roll out this new chemical, even though we don't know yet whether or not it's destructive, that we're not going to gain the economic benefit from it. Whereas there is substantial economic benefit, that is, an entire new industry can be birthed in determining whether or not chemicals are dangerous.
Exactly.
So,
you know, the whole thing of the environmental movement, and especially the toxic chemical wing of it, we began to get interesting information back in the 1960s, and we've been trying to figure this out ever since. And the beauty of what's going on right now is that there's a whole package of solutions. Green chemistry, green engineering are fields that have only been developed in the last 15 years. The precautionary principle, ecological economics, ecological medicine, all of these fields are brand new, and they're really arising in response to the great tragedies of our chemical era. So we both have a grievous problem on this planet, and especially in this country, and we are finding amazing solutions. And the precautionary principle is part of that philosophy that helps us drive at getting beautiful, healthy, respectful solutions to these problems that we've in some ways brought on ourselves.
I remember when Bill Moyers got some blood drawn and tested, and they found over 100 different chemicals in his blood that could be carcinogens or destructive to human health.
Exactly.
And he was rather shocked by that. And then he was told, this was all on the air on his Now program, the one that Tomlinson, now the head of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, says is too left wing for PBS. But in any case, anything that's not anti-industry or questions industry, shall we say. And he sounded shocked. And then the person said, well, you know, that's about average. The average person has over 100 different chemicals in their bloodstream that could cause disease, and one in three of us is going to get cancer in the United States. Has it always been this way?
No, and that's why I said earlier you can start saving for your daughter's mastectomy or her college education, because the statistics on those cancers or autism or certain birth defects are so alarming. When my mother got married, you know, however many years ago, one woman in 25 got breast cancer. 5 years ago, it was one woman in 8. Now it's one woman in 7. And when my 10-year-old niece gets married, it's predicted that one woman in 3 will get breast cancer. Not just all cancer, skin cancer, lung cancer, bladder cancer, but breast cancer alone. We also know that the increase in autism in California was 210% over 10 years. Certain birth defects have just skyrocketed. That can't be genetics anymore. You know, the genetics have not changed between my mother's generation and me.
And
Something else is going on.
And it's not diagnosis. I mean, with regard to autism, there are people who are running around saying, well, this is just that we're better at diagnosing it. Before, we just called these kids eccentric, and now we call them autistic. And there may be some small percentage of that, but there's, you know, autism is actually a pretty stark diagnosis.
These are
and birth defects and cancer. I mean, it's not a sort of you've got it. It's like being a little bit pregnant. I mean, it's all or nothing, really.
Well, certain birth defects are not obvious until, you know, learning disabilities and other things might not be obvious until a kid goes to school. But certain, you know, problems of the anatomy, you know, a little boy's reproductive system is obvious, and those are the kinds of birth defects that are going up. So when I think about the precautionary principle and I think about that kind of birth defect, you know, when you look at your little baby and it's not what you had hoped for that you conceived that child, that we're measuring the failures of our regulatory system in terms of suffering. If we can prevent that suffering, wouldn't that be a great idea? And that's what the precautionary principle stands for.
So how do people get involved in moving the United States or in moving their state government to adopt the precautionary principle as a scientific baseline rather than the WHOOPS principle?
Well, the exciting thing is that there's a lot going on in state and county governments. San Francisco adopted the precautionary principle as an overarching ordinance and are just now looking at new ways of implementing the precautionary principle so that they are mandating that the products that San Francisco purchases are the safest alternative to get whatever job done that they want to get done. We're seeing really innovative things in school districts. The Emeryville School District in California adopted the precautionary principle to guide all aspects of school life, from the food policy to the energy policy and curriculum, you name it. So across the country, we're seeing really wildly creative things.
That's absolutely marvelous. We've been talking with Carolyn Raffensperger, an environmental lawyer and former archaeologist, executive director of the Science and Environmental Health Network, Bioneers.org for Bioneers. And Carolyn, is there a website that you'd like to point people to?
Sure. www.sene.org.
Got to do it faster than that.
N.org.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Carolyn. I appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, video joints on every corner, 14 super discount stores, each one bigger than the last, with giant sales blowing out the doors.
Ah, yes, welcome to America. Welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Ellen Ratner is with us with the Talk Radio News Service with our report for the day from the belly of the beast, Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen.
Boy, is it a beast. I'll tell you, I was spent most of the morning at the hearings that Charles Grassley had on pensions, in particular United Airlines pension, and may this happen to other corporations. Two very interesting facts. First of all, he compared it to Enron. And secondly, there's this thing called smoothing technologies. And the smoothing technologies is an accounting maneuver that essentially allows them, as far as I understand it, which is not deep understanding, to put together profits and lost all together so that it's smooth, so that you can take a profit from several years ago and then put it with a loss of current, and it's still smoothed out over, not talking about what may actually be lost now. The other problems with pensions is that the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation and the Congressional Budget Office, which are essentially the watchdogs over this, don't get the data till 2 years afterwards.
Whoa.
So, essentially, you have data that's 2 years old. How are you going to know? How are people whose pensions are invested are going to know? There's just no way of knowing what's really happening.
Was there any discussion about the fact that the Pension Guarantee Corporation, Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, is now technically bankrupt and that they may be facing the same sort of outcome as the Savings and Loan, the Federal Savings and Loan Guarantee Corporation
well,
did under Bush Sr.?
Well, nobody said Savings and Loan, but it's very clear that they were bankrupt, and they did talk about it. Apparently, there's this 4010 report about the underfunding of pensions, and at this point now, we're looking at, and again, the data may be 2 years old, $354 billion, that's with a B, dollars.
Whoa. And now the savings and loan meltdown was around a half a trillion, wasn't it? About 500
right,
billion?
Right. But by the time we're done here, it may easily get to that.
Yeah, and if these are two-year-old figures and now we're having all these bankruptcies, I mean, the crescendo of conservative economics is just now starting to hit. We're really starting to see the result of the insanity of Bush's tax cuts and these policies. It's a new leveling, Ellen. It's a new world. It's like the idea that people should have pensions and they should be guaranteed is no longer being taken for granted.
Now, the other thing that the Pension Benefit Guarantee Manager, who is a Bush appointee, could not answer is if there are rules against, and exactly what the rules are, when a management of an airline or auto company can get his pension and the other people cannot. He thought there may be rules against that, but he wasn't sure and had to get back to the committee.
Well, clearly, I mean, there's the senior executives of Enron are getting pensions right now, and all the lower folks got nothing. They set them up with different corporations. They set them up with different kinds of pension programs.
It is really totally amazing on that front.
Yeah.
Okay. Something else. This is a very small thing that actually is in a bill. And it is going to help the U.S. manufacturers and also retail salesperson and wholesalers of alcohol. And now they're going to get a tax break. This tax was imposed during the Civil War, has been on there now. It's called special occupational taxes, and it was stuck into a bill in corporate tax legislation. It was approved, and now somebody has just discovered it, Tom. And, I mean, at the same time, the Supreme Court is saying, oh, no medical marijuana. We're going to lift the ban, lift some taxes on the biggest drug of all, which is alcohol.
Yeah, alcohol and tobacco are the two most addictive drugs out there. Amazing. Amazing. And you look at the damage. I mean, just 50,000 people a year die from drunk driving accidents every year. It's amazing. Amazing. Okay, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, our report from Washington, D.C. for the day. Ellen, thank you so much for being
here. You're
with
very welcome.
I do appreciate it. Good to hear from you, and always, always great to hear from you. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service, is the Tom Hartman radio program. You're listening to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. We'll be right back, 29 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
You gave them the old, stay the course, I'm your man. Why, he'll flip-flop ya.
Oh, he did so good.
He has no strength to lead. Yes, this you feared. While soldiers' jobs and surplus disappeared. Gave them the old,
devil, yet devil speak. Yes, with folks so windle come.
Ah, he did it so good.
No one could hear the truth above the roar.
He razzle-dazzled them.
And though your debating was a stinker, they bought it all, hook, line, and sinker. You razzle-dazzled them. And they gave you four more.
Too many OBGYNs aren't able to practice their love with women all across this country.
I hear there's rumors on the internets.
You cannot lead if you send mixed messages.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, my, what a beautiful day. TomHartman.com, our website, if you'd like to drop into our live chat room. And always interesting conversations. Some of the finest minds in all of cyberspace hanging out there in real time talking with each other. Folks from, I know, at least two continents are on right now in several different countries. Our telephone number, 866-889-8894. And lots going on.
Now, the Delay Political Death Watch.
Yes, at the behest of lobbyist Jack Abramoff, Tom Delay has worked to protect special labor laws for Saipan. They note at thinkprogress.org. Special labor laws, meaning let's not have an American minimum wage. Now, Saipan is an American protectorate. It is territory that we control. But Tom Delay has fought against imposing immigration restrictions in the federal minimum wage in Saipan, part of the U.S. territory, sometimes referred to as the Marianas Islands in the Pacific Ocean. Now, Delay, in the Galveston County Daily News last month, said that reports that workers were being abused or forced into the sex trade, the two major industries in Saipan being the sex trade and sweatshops, were, quote, incredible lies, end quote. This was Tom Delay. So Carmen Sita Abad has come forward and spoken out. She's a woman who worked in Saipan for 6 years. She says it's Tom Delay who has it wrong. She says, I quote, "My answer is, Mr. Delay, that I am a person. I am an example of an individual who can prove that the accounts of sweatshop labor and forced prostitution are not just allegations, but true accounts of working conditions in the Marianas Islands when Mr. Delay traveled there and turned a blind eye to our misery." Delay's denials, by the way, are also contradicted by two federal agencies and by congressmen from both parties who claim that the charges are true. Abad detailed the horrendous treatment of women on the island. She said, again quoting Carmen Sita Abad, "Women are fired for being pregnant, and to keep their jobs, any pregnant woman would either have to go to an illegal abortionist." You see, abortion is illegal there, too. Tom Delay has had his way. "Or try to induce miscarriage by drinking herbal potions or falling down on purpose. Women who are fired from work have no way to support themselves aside from the sex trade. There's no way to feed yourself aside from that," says Carmen Sita Abad. As these abuses occurred, and as Tom Delay was, you know, taking a bunch of his buddies on a trip to this place, this sweatshop sex trade paradise, as these abuses occurred, Jack Abramoff was paid $4.5 million to represent corporations who did business on the island. His job was to do whatever it took to convince politicians like Tom Delay to keep things exactly the same. And unfortunately for Carmen Sita Abad and others like her, note the bloggers over at thinkprogress.org, Mr. Abramoff and Mr. Delay have been successful. No minimum wage, no protections for workers. It is a laissez-faire Republican paradise, a Republican paradise. Alice in Humboldt County, California, what are your thoughts on all this, Alice?
Tom, I probably have been calling too frequently, but I do love your show.
Well, thank you.
Where else can we get the real news? You know that our government right now doesn't care about the people or the environment. That is the main problem with all of this.
Well, I think there are some people in our government who actually do. We had Dennis Kucinich on this program yesterday. Bernie Sanders is on every Friday. There are some good members of Congress, and I think there are a few decent senators as well. But you're absolutely right, Alice. The vast majority of them, because our system is fundamentally broken, unfortunately, tragically, and in large part this is the result of just a couple of Supreme Court decisions, Boston versus Bilotti and Buckley versus Viejo,
that because of these Supreme Court decisions that basically gave corporations and Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad that gave corporations rights as persons and then said that their First Amendment free speech right could be exercised with money because a corporation doesn't have a mouth, so it can use money to speak. These Supreme Court decisions have so corrupted the political process that many of the people who are now elected to political office are so beholden to their political contributors that they are no longer, as you say, representing we the people. We have to do something about that. We need to speak up.
Yeah. Well, keep working on it.
I will. And you too,
okay.
Alice. Thanks for the call. Great
I'm
to hear
working
from you.
On it, too.
Okay. Good on you. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. It's always great to hear from Alice. Okay. Tactics approved by Rumsfeld put soldiers at risk. This, you know, we in the first hour of the program, I was pointing out that Amnesty International USA, the executive director, William Schultz of the Amnesty International in the United States, has come out and said that any country that is concerned about the human rights abuses and torture that are being practiced by the United States should consider investigating the senior administration officials in the Bush administration, up to and including the president, and prosecuting them, and if they show up in those countries, arresting them. The same way General Augusto Pinochet was arrested in London when the Chilean former dictator showed up there. Now, frankly, between you and me, the odds of this happening are slim to none, but I thought it was a courageous call from the chairman, the executive director, rather, of Amnesty International USA. And because what we're seeing is that the Bush administration and George Jr. in particular are not advancing the interests of the United States around the world. They are not making us safer. They are not making the world a safer place. They're not advancing democracy. They're running around saying, "Oh, we liberated 50 million people." No, I'm sorry. The people in Iraq would beg to differ. Over 90% of them now want us to leave, thank you very much. Yeah, it was nice you brought down Saddam. You know, eventually he would have died. Nations bring about democracy generally internally. They do it themselves. There's two ways that nations make that transition, because people will say, you know, the right-wing response to this would be, "Well, what about World War II? We liberated those nations. We brought democracy to Germany and Japan, didn't we?" Yeah. And what had happened in those two countries... And this is a really important point that so many people fail to get. What had happened in those two countries was that the populations of Germany and Japan, the average person in Germany and Japan, and I've done a lot of business in Japan and I've lived in Germany, so I'm telling you this firsthand knowledge, you know, been there, seen that, the populations in those two countries leading up to World War II had gone insane. They had gone insane. They had gone nuts. There was a widespread form of national mental illness that happened in the 1930s in Germany and Japan and a few other places as well, but particularly in those two countries, because their leaders had gone insane and in an infectious way, and their leaders were using fear and lies to create insanity among the people. And so the people not only put up with, you know, things like you know, the rape of Nanking and the murder of Jews in Germany, not only put up with it, but in many cases cheered it. And so what happened was, when we defeated these nations in World War II, it was like a drunk having cold water splashed in his face. All of a sudden it was like, "Whoa, what happened?" And when the average person in Japan was confronted with the reality of the Japanese atrocities in China and other parts of the world, and when the average citizen of Germany was confronted with the atrocities of the Third Reich, they looked around and said, "How could this have happened? We went insane. This is not something civilized people do." And they repented, to borrow a phrase from religion. They awakened, and they said, "You know, no, and they apologized. They made reparations. They made things straight. A period of national insanity. They recovered from a period of national insanity. They awoken. They awakened. And that's why, when we occupied Germany and when we occupied Japan, and this was before my time, but my father was a member of the occupation forces in Japan. And, you know, he's told us stories about that. We did not lose a single soldier. Now, granted, after the invasion of Iraq, Donald Rumsfeld, who should have known better, went on national television and said that after World War II, there were all these Germans who were shooting at our soldiers in Germany. Turns out, ain't true. It's just not the case. I mean, certainly there are some, there to this day, there are people in Germany who call themselves Nazis. And, you know, and every now and then some Japanese soldier straggles out of the forest in Borneo going, huh, what happened? It's probably been 4 or 5 years since the last one came out, but, you know, every now and then. But the reality is that the Japanese and the Germans said, okay, you know, we screwed up. We really screwed up. Tojo was nuts. Hitler was nuts. And we're not going to do that anymore. In fact, we would appreciate your help in becoming like you guys. And so we helped the Germans write a constitution, and we came in with a Marshall Plan, and we helped them rebuild their country. And they didn't fight us because they didn't view it as a hostile occupation, because they viewed us as the folks who helped them awaken from national insanity. Now, I think that you could probably successfully argue that had the United States gone into Iraq, toppled Saddam, and then immediately left, that there might have been a positive outcome. Might. I would put the probabilities probably around 30%. Or, actually, more effectively, you could argue that if you want a probability around 70 or 80% of a positive outcome, had George Bush Sr. gone all the way into Baghdad and taken out Saddam and then left, that Iraq might be a more democratic nation today. It might even be a democracy. I think you could probably successfully argue that there's a possibility, maybe even a probability, particularly if it had been done in 91. But we are now perceived in Iraq and around the world as an occupying force. I mean, it's just remarkable, the research that has been done on this. There's a new book out. I don't have it right in front of me. We're trying to get the author on it. Just remarkable. This new book, this guy looked into Muslim, into suicide bombing. And the suicide bombing is not an Islamic originated idea. It started out with the Tamil Tigers. I've been in Sri Lanka. And up in Kandy, you go up north, up to Kandy, and the region where up into the Tamil region, and there were these, they considered themselves freedom fighters. And they felt that they were being occupied by the people from the south, you know, there's all these different regions down the south. They felt like they were being occupied, and they wanted their independence. And they created the suicide vests. They invented them. And they were Hindus. They were not Muslims. And so what you see around the world is that suicide bombings and fighting back, as it were, are the tactics of people not who are trying to get to heaven, not who are religiously motivated, but who are politically motivated, who are trying to overthrow what they perceive to be an occupying force, an occupying army. So, you know, what clearly happened in World War II, you know, we helped awaken these, we helped these people basically overthrow insane leaders. And like I said, you could argue that when Hussein invaded Kuwait, and yeah, we probably set him up to do it. It looks like April Gillespie said, yeah, go ahead. And he said, okay, cool, I'll do it. And, you know, it was just a setup from the very beginning. But nonetheless, I think you could argue, you know, had we taken him out at that point, there was opposition forces, there was a resistance within Iraq that could have emerged and taken over the country, and hopefully it would have turned into a democracy over time. And it would have been an organic internal process, because that's how it has happened with the 100-and-some-odd countries around the world that have become democratic, by and large. The two exceptions, as I pointed out, being Germany and Japan, and those are exceptional exceptions. But now we have a situation where the United States has become the purveyor of torture. We're no longer the example that countries want to follow. In fact, countries are pointing at us and saying that we're the abusers. And Rumsfeld, by approving these tactics, is putting our own soldiers at risk. Our citizens, when our citizens travel around the world, they are at risk now because of what Bush and Rumsfeld have done, and Cheney and the whole crew. And our soldiers around the world are at risk because of what Rumsfeld and Cheney and Bush have done. And this, you know, ranging from our interrogation and torture techniques that have been ratified and by Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney and condemned by Amnesty International, to our preemptive war, you know, claiming that preemptive war is a legitimate thing. No, the last country to have claimed that preemptive war was legitimate was Hitler in Russia, in Germany, in the 1930s when he wanted to invade Poland. And he said Poland was threatening him. And therefore he had to have a preemptive war against Poland. It was a year after the Anschluss, after they took Vienna, after they took Austria. And the world is looking at us going, have these folks gone nuts? We have to produce political change in the United States if we're going to restore the integrity and ideals of this nation. 10 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm George W. Bush, and I approve this message.
They gave up the old Bible Belt bailey-hoo. You bamboozled them.
Yes, he did.
Get your AWOL and your DUI.
They totally forgot.
You gave them a show that always pleases. Your friends claimed you were endorsed by Jesus. You razzle-dazzled them, razzle-dazzled them, razzle-dazzled them, and made sane people cry.
And welcome back, my friends. That from the Billionaires for Bush, by the way. Several folks in the chat room have asked, you know, where does that music come from? That particular piece is from Billionaires for Bush, billionairsforbush.org, the website. And just some marvelous pastiche of the music from the show Chicago, actually. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Diane in Grand Rapids on the line. Hey, Diane.
Hi, Tom. You were talking about suicide bombers going back to the Tamil Tigers.
Yeah.
Well, a couple years ago, there was a lot of propaganda out that suicide bombing was something entirely new to our times. So I asked, when I had an opportunity, asked an expert in terrorism from Scotland Yard, who was a professor at Grand Valley,
mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, no, it's very old. Suicide bombing actually goes back before explosives. And he thought back, and he finally said he thought the earliest, you know, back before kamikaze pilots and back before that, and he thought the earliest incidents was in the first century A.D. when the Jews were fighting the Romans.
Yeah.
They had a poisoned person that would go and, you know, make a big fuss, and then when all the Roman soldiers came to kill him, the people that were in hiding would
come out. Well, it's what they did at Masada. That's what happened in Masada, yeah, in the first century.
Right. That you take them with you,
yeah.
And that's
although they were not taking the Romans with them. They were just saying, "We will not be captured."
Well, that's real different. But he said that they did have a tactic where one person would sacrifice themselves to take a whole bunch of Romans with them.
Interesting. Well, thank you, Diane, for that.
That's fine.
Always learn something new every day. I have the smartest listeners in all of talk radio, I'll tell you. It's remarkable. Diane, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Yep. Take nothing less. Take absolutely nothing less.
been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Speaking of mental illness, in the last hour, we're talking about how Germany and Japan went collectively insane in the years leading up to World War II and throughout World War II. And it's a type of mental illness that affects countries and people from time to time. History is, you know, throughout history you find these unfortunate epidemics, shall we say, scattered about. And now we find in the New York Times today, Benedict Carey reporting that more than half of Americans will develop a mental illness at some point in their lives. This is where it's starting to get a little weird. The question in my mind is, number one, you got the National Institute of Mental Health. They just sponsored this very substantial, comprehensive study. And Benedict Carey points out the findings of those studies are frequently cited by, and then he lists, you know, researchers, advocacy groups, policymakers, and drug manufacturers to emphasize the importance of diagnosing and treating mental illness. Yes, drug manufacturers. So, you know, there's somebody who's got a vested interest in this thing, in saying, you know, half of Americans are nuts or suffering from mental illness or will at some point in their lives. Could it be that one of the manifestations that we're seeing, one of these, you know, this spread of national mental illness is a function of conservative economic policies and conservative crime policies. We have more people in prison right now in the United States, both on a per capita basis and in absolute numbers, than any other nation on earth. Now, it may be that China has more in absolute numbers. Nobody's really sure. But so far, we have the numbers seem that we actually have more people in prison than even China does. Number one. Number two, I mean, you know, where else in the world are you hearing about kids going nuts in school and just, you know, shooting up the school? I'm wondering. We do know that there is a relationship between the economic health of a nation and suicide. There's a chapter about this, or part of a chapter about this in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? A fascinating British study that was done that found that when conservative governments came into power in the United Kingdom, that suicides went up, and when liberal governments came in, what they call labor governments there, suicides go down. And they tracked it, you know, going all the way back to World War I. Whenever the labor government came in, suicides went down. Whenever the conservative government came in, suicides went up. And my recollection, I don't have the book in front of me, and I'd have to go back and look at it, but my recollection is that a conservative government was worth about 30,000 suicides. Now, I don't recall if it was per year or per term, you know, 4, 5, 6 years, however long that government may survive. Thatcher, in particular, they talked about that there were many, many suicides under Thatcher because the economy started falling apart and families were stressed out. The conservative governments, by and large, put into place economic policies that make it harder for workers to have rights, that make it harder for workers to have decent salaries, that make health care less available, that diminish the availability of pensions, that diminish the commons, that make, you know, public transportation less useful and less functional, that make it harder to be alive as part of the working poor or the working class. And this produces stresses on families, and this stress on families then produces violence, and very often that violence is self-directed, thus suicide. So, you know, I'm finding the timing of this study interesting. The headline, actually, in the New York Times, most will be mentally ill at some point, study says. But then there's also the question of, you know, how do you define mental illness? The old joke about, you know, if you're rich, it's not called mental illness, it's called eccentricity. And where are we drawing the boundaries? Where are we drawing the borders? It's an important one. But I think that there is a certain mental illness that is starting to sweep the United States, and it's one that is not unlike what was seen in Germany and Japan in the early stages. And we are very much in the early stages of it, where we can still catch it. We can still stop it, hopefully. And here is a symptom of it, of our national insanity. This is from the newspaper. It's called The Times. A newspaper in a little town called Webster Groves in the state of Missouri. In Webster Groves, Missouri, a little town, kid named Ben Garrett, under the gun, shall we say. Well, I'll just share with you the story. Don Corrigan wrote this story for the Times Online of Webster Grove, Missouri. The American Civil Liberties Union is demanding records of activities carried out under the Patriot Act that it sees as political intimidation of citizens, including a number of Missouri residents. And keep in mind, this is a local story, but, you know, if it's happening anywhere, it's happening everywhere. The ACLU is seeking documents under FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, that detail activities of the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force, the JTTF, among state residents unjustifiably targeted, according to the ACLU, is Ben Garrett, a 1998 Webster Groves High School graduate who has been attending Truman State University in Kirksville, Missouri. Danny Harmon, stepfather to Garrett, was surprised to find the FBI knocking on his Webster Groves door last year. Questions asked revolved around Garrett's political activism and intentions to protest at the 2004 presidential nominating conventions. You getting this? The FBI investigating people who are politically active? Skylar Harmon, Garrett's mother, said, Ben's stepdad was shocked by their appearance at the door. He tried to be as cooperative as possible. I was not at home at the time, but I'm pretty sure I would not have been as helpful. She added, Ben has some strong political beliefs, but he totally believes in nonviolence. It's too bad that our Patriot Act gives authorities license to harass people with political views that differ from this administration. She says, I hope the ACLU finds out exactly how our tax money is being misused for this kind of harassment instead of being used to protect the American public from real terrorism. His mother, by the way, a longtime local school teacher. The FOIA request was filed about 3 weeks ago, May 18th, by the ACLU of Eastern Missouri. And it's among numerous requests from individuals and groups in Missouri, Georgia, Idaho, Kentucky, Maine, North Carolina, Rhode Island, Wisconsin, and more. Brenda Jones, the executive director of the ACLU EM, said, "Civil liberties are being that's Eastern Missouri. Civil liberties are being violated, and it's happening here in Missouri." She said, we believe that the FBI is working with local law enforcement agencies through so-called joint terrorism task forces to spy on individuals and groups engaged in entirely lawful, constitutionally protected activity. They want to know what's going on. Turns out three kids in this little town, Webster Groves, were put under surveillance by the FBI. Garrett was one of them. His two friends, they're all in their 20s, Chris Sheets and Daniel Coate, all residents of Kirksville at the time. The FBI had to go into Kirksville and track these kids down because they were going to go to the political conventions. The spokesperson from the FBI office says, we're not commenting on individual situations. The allegations by the ACLU have been made before, and they're entitled to their opinion. Yeah. Anthony Romero, the national director of the ACLU, said FBI spying on peaceful demonstrators is a waste of taxpayer money and infringement on free speech guarantees. As Dan Corrigan wrote in the Times Online, quoting Romero, the FBI's intimidation and interrogation of peaceful protesters brings back eerie echoes of the J. Edgar Hoover days. Resources and funds established to fight terrorism should not be used to target innocent Americans. And then Garrett tells his story. He's talking to the reporter for this newspaper. He was in Webster Groves this past weekend for a sibling's graduation. He says, "We were questioned by the FBI in July 2004 in Kirksville, and then they tailed us all over when we went to St. Louis. They sat in their car outside my friend's houses. The neighbors called the local police on them. The police were shown their FBI credentials when they showed up. The agents followed us to a meeting we had with the ACLU in St. Louis. They even followed us when we went to a movie." He says, "More than anything, I hope all of this exposes the Patriot Act for a misuse of funds and executive power. I also think so much money is involved, they just don't know how to spend it all. How can they justify using money to have cars follow a bunch of young people going to a movie?" To a movie. Lieberman of the ACLU, he says, "A lot of people are going to say, if you don't have anything to hide, why should you care if the FBI comes to ask a few questions? But the point is, this is a country where you're not supposed to receive a knock on your door because of your political beliefs. Supposed to be. I mean, we were founded on that, right? And lest you think that, you know, the whole terrorism thing, oh, no, they're only going to use the terrorism laws against terrorists. I mean, we, you know, we passed the Patriot Act protecting us against terrorism, and it will only be used against terrorists. We're not, you know, they're not going to use this against average folks. They're not going to use this against political protesters. They're not going to use this against people who are engaged in protest of corporate activity. No. Just terrorists." John Hurdle wrote for Reuters, Byline Philadelphia, "New Jersey is using an anti-terrorism law for the first time to try six animal rights activists charged with harassing and vandalizing a company that made use of animals to test its drugs." These accused members of the Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty Group are facing 3 years in prison. SHAC argued that the charges are a violation of free speech rights and it's a victim of a government crackdown on dissent. The group said on its website, "This is a frightening step in the Bush administration's path to war on domestic dissidents." The defendants are also charged with interstate stalking, which carries a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison, $250,000 fine, conspiracy to engage in interstate stalking, same penalty. The list of potential defense witnesses includes actress Kim Basinger, who joined a protest outside a Huntington laboratory in Franklin, New Jersey, to try to stop such companies using animals to test their pharmaceutical products. So now people who are protesting, well, let's say that they're vandals. Let's say, you know, I don't know. I don't have the details here. But let's say that they broke in and they vandalized this company. We already have laws against that. There are laws against vandalism. There are laws against trespass. There are laws against the destruction of private property. We don't have to surrender our civil liberties to protect ourselves from animal rights activists. There are already laws against that kind of stuff. Oh, but we would only use these laws. We would only use the expansion of these laws, the diminution of our rights to fight terrorists. Yeah. 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Don't think of buying from Canada. Oh, we will not play nice. We wrote the new legislation forcing the nation to pay the top price. Oh, Grandma, sign the paper. Grandpa, don't be slow. Yes, you get medication if you join our HMO.
Yes. Oh, yeah, just join our HMO. Everything will be fine, Grandma. Yeah, the Republicans are in charge. Everything is going to be fine, yes. For example, just sign that energy bill, members of the Senate and the House. Just, you know, just vote for that thing so good old George can put his name on it. Now we find this in the political insanity. Today is our sanity day, I guess. Sanity, insanity. This political insanity. Former Enron executives slated to receive taxpayer handouts for a new project. This is from a press release from Public Citizen. You know, one of the fine things that Ralph Nader did with his life, creating Public Citizen, citizen.org. Buried in the 700-plus page energy bill currently under debate in the U.S. Senate is a provision that provides hundreds of millions of dollars worth of federal loan guarantees for a power plant apparently to be built by four former Enron executives. One of those former executives is Thomas White, the former head of Enron's retail and energy trading in California during the energy crisis. Now, this is the guy who brought down Gray Davis. This is the guy who brought down California. The burn, baby, burn guy. Thomas White. He was rewarded, of course, by George Bush by being given the job of Secretary of the Army. Until it became kind of embarrassing. Public Citizen's investigation to find out who this loan would heighten. See, this little piece of language, it's entitled Title 14, Section 1403, sub C, sub 1, sub B of the Senate Energy Bill, provides federal loan guarantees for, quote, a project to produce energy from coal mined in the western United States using appropriate advanced integrated gasification combined cycle technology, blah blah blah, that shall be located in a western state at an altitude greater than 4,000 feet. Now, this is how they do it. When they want to say, okay, we want to give welfare to Joe Blow's company, but we can't say Joe Blow's company. You can't just say, you know, this is a tax credit for Tom White and his friends from Enron. So what you do is you say, this only applies to companies who are located, within 22 miles of this particular city at an elevation of over 4,000 feet, that are using this particular technology, quack, quack, quack. And it turns out there's only one company in the world that actually meets all that criteria. And sure enough, they've discovered it. It's called the Medicine Bow Fuel and Power Company. It's going to be doing a $2.8 billion coal gasification project in Medicine Bow, Wyoming. And this bill, this little kicker that's been tossed into this piece of legislation, will mean that if these guys invest in this thing, they are guaranteed a return on their investment. Because if the company goes down, you and I pay for it. We bail them out. And if the company is successful, they make a profit. These guys don't believe in capitalism. These Bush cronies, they don't believe in capitalism. They believe in crony capitalism. They believe in get what you can from the people. This is a Houston-based company called DKRW Energy. And they've got a subsidiary, the Medicine Bow Fuel and Power Company, and it's four Enron guys, including Thomas White. The federal loan guarantee makes taxpayers responsible for repaying the loan if the company defaults, or if the project is unfeasible, or even determined to be so during its construction. Now, who slipped this thing in? We don't know. The committee has approved the bill. It's scheduled for Senate action as early as this week. Joan Claybrook, the president of Public Citizen, is saying Congress shouldn't be in the business of slipping taxpayer subsidies into large bills to benefit individual corporations, especially executives from a company that perpetrated one of the greatest corporate frauds in American history. Well, keep in mind, Ken Lay was also the biggest lifetime patron of George Bush Jr. Might have something to do with it. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Walk that walk. Talk that talk.
And get out there and get active. Tom Hartman here, back with you. Welcome back to our program. Vigtam? I'm not sure how it's pronounced. Vigtam? In our chat room, V-E-G-T-A-M, is in Norway. and telling us that today is the day that Norway is declaring, is celebrating, 100 years of freedom from Sweden. So the Swedes, they're a little unhappy, but the Norwegians, they're having a good time. Now, I can't do a Norwegian accent, unfortunately, and I should remember one. My grandfather and grandmother, my paternal grandfather and grandmother came from Norway, and my grandfather had a good Norwegian accent, and I can still hear it in my head. They're no longer with us. God bless them. But I can't quite do it. This is almost a German accent, but not quite. Anyhow, I love Norway. Beautiful country. Been there many times. In fact, when Bush was first elected in 2000, or selected in 2000, my first comment to Louise was, let's emigrate to Norway. It was in jest. It was in jest. She didn't think it was. She said, no, we're going to stay here. And I said, yes, of course we're going to stay here. It was just a joke. Okay, when did this Swift report, you got it. This is incredible. This is just absolutely great. I love it. When Zechariah Goodman recently sought out the help of a therapist, it was no mystery as to what was ailing him. The 27-year-old copy editor, this is swiftreport.blogs.com, this 27-year-old copy editor was so consumed by his belief that President George W. Bush stole the 2004 election that he was having trouble sleeping, completing rudimentary tasks at work, and carrying on conversations about topics not related to politics. The therapist he consulted wrote Goodman a prescription for the social anxiety drug Paxil and encouraged him to spend less time reading left-wing blogs and listening to Air America. This particular story has a happy ending. Goodman admits that he's already far less irritating to be around than he was just weeks ago, but countless paranoids just like him are going untreated, say mental health professionals. Did you get this? Paranoia? Now a group of Republican lawmakers is hoping they can do something about the problem. Early this summer, Senator Bill Frist, the first practicing physician elected to the Senate since 1928, plans to file a bill that would define political paranoia as a mental disorder, paving the way for individuals who suffer from paranoid delusions regarding voter fraud, political persecution, and FBI surveillance to receive Medicare reimbursement for their psychiatric treatment. Rick Smith, a spokesman for Senator Frist, says the measure has a good chance of passing, something that can only help a portion of the population that is suffering significant distress. Says Smith, if you're still convinced that President Bush won the election because Republicans figured out a way to hack into electronic voting machines, you've obviously got a problem. If we can figure out a way to ease your suffering by getting you into therapy and onto medication, that's something we hope the entire 109th Congress will support. Now, this is particularly an effort that is supported by popular conservative radio talk show host Michael Savage, whose new book has titled, and I kid you not, seriously, Liberalism is a Mental Disorder. In this book, he shares his observations of the affliction that he likens to a national cancer. So the cure is coming. And here's the new test from the American Psychiatric Association for the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. The answers, it's one of these, you know, fill in the little circle things with the number two pencil. And there's, you know, zero is not at all, one a little bit, two somewhat, three very much, four extremely. Some of the questions. Number one, I experience feelings of anger or rage when I see pictures of George W. Bush. Number two, I'm bothered when I see bumper stickers or other insignia in support of Bush Cheney 04. Number three, I believe that the Republican victory in the presidential election was the result of fraud. Number four, I cannot watch Fox News Channel without becoming enraged. Number seven, people at my office or gym think there may be something wrong with me. Number eight, I listen to liberal talk radio. Number nine, I think the FBI may be listening in on my phone conversations. Number 10, I'm opposed to the concept of an ownership society. Number 11, I think the best way to ensure quality health care is for all Americans to socialize medicine. Number 14, I think that Dan Rather is unbiased in his reporting. Number 15, I was a supporter of John Kerry in the last election. Number 16, I have trouble admitting that I suffer from political paranoia disorder. PPI. So if you answer yes to a majority of those questions, you qualify for government-paid Paxil, courtesy of Bill Frist. Yes, it's a parody. It is supposed to be funny. The Swift Report is supposed to be funny. Now, here's where it stops being funny. We move from parody to actual news report. This is from the Sierra Times, sierratimes.com. In the 2005-2006 school year, Article by Nancy Levant, L-E-V-A-N-T. All parents will receive written notice of new policies from your children's schools. Many schools will ask you to sign permission slips that allow school counselors or what they call advocates to have conversations with your children. You'll be told how your local schools are now involved in vision screening, dental screening, looking for learning disabilities, speech impediment screening, other acts of kindness. But Nancy Levant says, check out the fine print. Watch for wording like happiness indicators or family participation. Because she says that President Bush's new Freedom Initiative and new Freedom Commission on Mental Health are mandating that every American child ages 3 through 18 is federally ordered to be evaluated for mental health issues and to receive enforced treatment. 52 million students and 6 million adults working in schools, according to this commission, will be tested and should flush out at least 6 million people, or shall we say new customers, who will then be mandated to receive treatment. What treatment does our President's Commission have in mind? Well, the newest drugs in the pharmaceutical pipelines, of course. State-of-the-art treatments. The most state-of-the-art, an implanted capsule, a time-release. It goes under the skin, time-release antidepressant. So you don't have to worry about your child taking their pills. This is based on the Texas Medication Algorithm Project, TMAP, a model treatment plan that's being waved around for the entire United States. Many companies who support TMAP were also major contributors to Bush's reelection funds. For example, Eli Lilly manufactures olanzapine, one of the drugs recommended in the new Freedom Plan. And furthermore, George Herbert Walker Bush was once a member of Lilly's board of directors. Our current President Bush appointed Lilly's chief executive officer, Sidney Taurel, as a member of the Homeland Security Council. 82% of Lilly's $1.6 million in political contributions in 2000 went to Bush and the Republican Party. Right. The Texas algorithm grossed over $4 billion in 2003, and olanzapine is Eli Lilly's top-selling drug. 70% of olanzapine sales are paid for by government agencies. Public schools can now be paid to screen and drug your kids. But wait, there's more, writes Nancy. The new Freedom Commission also calls for enforced treatment. This means that parents have no rights to refuse the treatment recommended by TMAP and other drug-dispensing corporate bureaucratic apparatuses. If you try to refuse, parents and families will be investigated via the result of their children's screenings in schools. This, I think, should give us all chills. A little paranoia. Now, would the drug companies really support something that might be wrong? Would the drug companies, I mean, would the big pharmaceutical companies, even though there's billions to be made, treating political paranoia disorder, that being tongue-in-cheek, but I mean the very real problem of the government coming into our schools and saying, okay, we're going to check everybody out. We've decided what's normal, and if you're not normal, you have to take these pills. And by the way, let me add, to the best of my knowledge, there has not yet been a school shooter who was not on pharmaceutical medication, either at the time of the shooting or in the recent past. Now, I know the pharmaceutical industry says, well, see, that proves they were mentally ill. And mentally ill people, even when they're medicated, sometimes go off the edge. But there are others of us who are a little concerned that perhaps some of these drugs, particularly the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, the SSRI drugs, may have a side effect of producing increasing rates of suicide. And in fact, the pharmaceutical manufacturers have now owned up to this, although they tried to keep it hidden. They've now owned up to it. And some people, when they commit suicide, take other people with them. And so it may be that the school shootings that we've been seeing in the United States by children who are taking SSRI drugs are actually not murders, they're actually suicides in the child's mind, where they're bringing along a few friends or taking out a few enemies. But the ultimate goal is suicide. So for every, you know, 1,000 or 5,000 kids who quietly commit suicide on these drugs, there's one or two who spectacularly, you know, I use the word not in its positive sense, you know what I mean, take out a whole bunch of other people along with themselves. But the drug companies, they would not behave dishonorably, would they? I mean, they have our best interests in mind, don't they? I would suggest you might want to check out the front page of today's Wall Street Journal. John Wilkie wrote an article there, upper right-hand corner, lead story. Months before a new law kicks in that will dramatically escalate government spending on drugs, state and federal prosecutors are investigating 150 cases that involve alleged pricing fraud by some of the world's largest drug makers that could produce more than $1 billion in criminal fines and civil penalties this year. They are focused on allegations that drug companies cheat state and federal health care programs by inflating prices, offering undisclosed rebates to distributors, or marketing drugs for unapproved uses, according to lawyers and officials involved in these cases. A half dozen major drug makers have already paid fines and penalties to settle charges in the past 2 years. Oh, I see. If you go in and rob a 7-Eleven, you go to jail. If you rob the American people, you pay a fine. If you're a pharmaceutical company, you just pay a fine. That's all. Criminal or civil penalties already paid by selected drug companies to settle allegations of pricing fraud. Pfizer, in May of 2004, paid $430 million in fines, having to do with fraud on their drug Neurotonin. AstraZeneca, in June of 2003, $355 million in fines for fraud relating to their drug Zoladex. Schering Plough, in July of 2004, $345 million in fines regarding to fraud in their drug Claritin. Bayer, or Bayer, as they say in the United States, $257 million in fines paid in April of 2003. Related to fraud for their drugs Cipro and Aladat. GlaxoSmithKline, April 2003, $88 million in fines paid for committing fraud relative to Paxil and Flonase. Fines and penalties this year could amount to almost twice the totals paid in each of the past 3 years, officials said, notes John Wilkie in his article in the Wall Street Journal. The number of separate civil and criminal investigations underway stands at 150 and involves nearly 500 drugs. Now, why is the government all of a sudden getting interested in this? And that's the whole point of this article, by the way, that the government is all of a sudden getting interested in it. That these fines that I told you about have been, you know, based on relatively slow and lax. These are not words that they use in the article, but you get the sense, you know, that it's really only a small piece of this. And in fact, they even note, while the criminal and civil penalties and settlements represent a small fraction of drug company profits, they're rising fast. Why is the government all of a sudden concerned about it? Because they didn't mind when these companies were ripping off you and me and grandma. But starting next year, Medicare is going to be paying for drugs. And they'd rather that they weren't being ripped off. The Bush administration looking out for their own. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number if you'd like to call in. Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Roy, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Tom. I was appreciating that rant. They're obscene. They are absolutely obscene. And with the SSRIs, you didn't mention that several people committed suicides under trials.
Yeah.
While they were doing the drug trials, and they were not only committed suicide, they covered it up.
Yeah, the drug companies. Yeah, and this came out just a few months ago, or 6 months ago.
Within the last couple, 3 months. And then not only that, there is the terrific increase in suicides on folks that are trying to get off the darn things.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, you know, I've helped a few people wean their way down, and that stuff gets nasty when they're getting off of it.
Yeah, that's my understanding, and we're concerned about heroin, right? We're concerned about pot.
At least heroin, you go in and you kind of get sick for a couple of days, but you don't kill anybody. You're too weak and too hurt to do anything.
Yeah,
I actually called in to comment on the surveillance thing that you were talking about last half hour or whenever.
Okay, we've got about 30 seconds, Roy.
I've had it come up so many times that what they're doing is they're intimidating people to stay the hell away from protests and meetings and
absolutely.
Whatnot.
This is called open surveillance. It's hey, we're here.
And so everybody's saying, well, I'd like to come, but I don't want to get in trouble.
Right.
I don't want to be known. I don't want to be on a file someplace.
Yeah. Have you heard of this happening in New Mexico?
You mean the surveillance stuff?
Yeah, yeah.
I know it's a case. They were taking my picture out here when we were protesting Cheney.
Yeah.
So, you know, I hope that maybe I'll get my file.
it's a sad commentary on the state of affairs in America.
Germany in 31, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, or 33, okay. Actually, I'd say.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah. There you go.
Take care.
Thanks
appreciate
a lot,
it.
Roy. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Oh, my. Well, we've got to change, and change begins with us. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman. It's cold.
Yeah, wrapping up the show here. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you 5 minutes before the hour. And just a little thought from Georgie for the day.
Free. And freedom is beautiful. And, you know, it'll take time to restore chaos and order, but we will.
It's going to take time to restore chaos, but don't worry. We'll take care of that. Yeah, well, it's been a year and a half and, you know, 1,000 Americans dead and tens of thousands of Iraqis dead and chaos has been restored, hasn't it? I guess, it wasn't a malapropism. It was George simply telling the truth, apparently. The top contributors to Governor Schwarzenegger have been rewarded. You get this? This story from the Associated Press out over the weekend. And I'm really interested to see how this thing plays, whether this story is going to end up having legs in California. Because I remember when Schwarzenegger, back when he was running for governor, got away with saying that special interest groups were things like the teachers union and the civil servants union, the service employees union and so on, and the governmental employees union, that the unions were special interest groups. Environmentalists were special interest groups, and therefore he wouldn't take their money, and they shouldn't have anything to do, they shouldn't have any say in the halls of government. But if corporations wanted to donate money to him and his efforts, because they were creating jobs in America, they were not special interest groups, and he would stand with them. And I just, you know, I was just, people in California are hearing this, and they're buying it. I mean, first of all, nobody creates jobs. People want to manufacture products, so they want to provide a service in order to make money. And if you can make $20 an hour off somebody's labor and you can hire them for $19 or $18 or $17 or anything less than that, then you do it. Unless you're in the early stages of a business and trying to build it and you're losing money on it, which, you know, a lot of companies do in the startup phase. But over time, I mean, the bottom line is that, you know, labor, you people do whatever it is, the jobs that are created because they're making profits for people. So it's not about altruism. It's not about creating jobs. But now we have this situation here where Schwarzenegger is saying, if you give him a lot of money, give Schwarzenegger a pile of money, you get a secret phone number, and every other week you can call up and be in on his personal strategy sessions and, you know, inside his insider circle, his inside political circle. So far, the American Electronics Association, the Associated Builders and Contractors Incorporated, and Wells Fargo have ponied up and participated in these things. There's apparently nothing illegal about this as long as they don't say, hey, how about writing a check to the Wells Fargo bank, you know? But, boy, is this unseemly. We'll see how it plays. This is going to be one of those things I want to keep an eye on for a while. Thanks for being with us today. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. See you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.